Hey, I'm Morgan Rhodes, and if you're listening to us, you're listening around Drive Time, which is the Max Fun Drive, and we just want to talk to you about Max Fun and how great it is. Max Fun's business model is artist-owned, and it's audience-supported, so that means when you become a member, you are directly affecting our ability to continue this show, and we would love to continue this show, as well as Max Fun's ability to plan for other future shows.
We know these might be challenging financial times, given everything that's going on. So you can really choose the monthly amount that's most comfortable for you. Majority of the folks give around $5 to $10 a month. Some upgrade to $20, $35, even $100 if you're balling out like that. But it's really about what works for you. Right. Everything helps.
You can visit MaximumFun.org/join and you'll see all the ways you can give. Whatever you give, just know that we are really grateful for the level of support and for you rocking with us for this long.
Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, you know, an album that just burns its way into our collective memory. And today, we will be cold lamping with flavor by revisiting one of the greatest undisputed albums in the history of hip-hop. Nay, of actually popular music writ large, that is Public Enemy's 1988 album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. As I've mentioned on the show before, I didn't start listening to hip-hop in earnest until the summer of 1989, and back then it didn't occur to me to go back to earlier recordings that I might have missed, and this meant that I never heard It Takes a Nation of Millions when it first came out. My introduction to it didn't come until the winter of 1990, when I took a copy of the Less Than Zero soundtrack on cassette tape with me overseas to visit family. I might have copped that soundtrack because it had LL Cool J's Going Back to Cali on the A side, but waiting in the wings for me on the flip was Public Enemy's Bring the Noise.
Yo, Chuck, these honey drippers are still fronting on us. Show them that we can do this, because we always do this. Yeah, boy!
Bass, how low can you go? Death row, what a brother, no, once again, back is the incredible...
Imagine that song being your introduction to Public Enemy and the Bomb Squad. To quote Rakim, it was hyper than a heart attack. Once I got back to the States, I immediately went and bought It Takes a Nation of Millions, and even if I needed a late pass to arrive to it, I understood why, back then, it was considered hip-hop's greatest album. And take your pick here, the unique pairing of Chuck D's baritone flow and the piercing ad-libs from the ultimate court jester Flavor Flav, the Bomb Squad's approach to stacking samples on samples on samples to create a thrilling, overwhelming wall of sound, the group's pummeling political polemics. Hip-hop has gone through many eras, many changes in style, but in the late 80s, an album like this felt revolutionary in terms of the music and culture's creative and social import. It wasn't just a stylistic leap forward. It Takes a Nation of Millions incited debate and awakened consciousness in a way that would forever reshape what we thought hip-hop could be and could do. Over 30 years later, that impact hasn't faded much at all. This album still feels and sounds louder than a bomb.
Come on, get with it. Something ain't right, I got to admit it. Made me mad when I was on tour that I declared war. I'm Black Radio. They say that I plan this. On the radio, most of you will demand this.
It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back was the album pick of our guest today, Mr. Muhammad, a.k.a. Ali Shaheed Muhammad of A Tribe Called Quest.
Roy Ayers said once, DJs and people in the streets know what they like. I'm so glad that our guest knew that he liked Ronnie Foster's Mystic Brew, that he liked Weldon Ravine's We Gettin' Down, that he liked Bob James's Nautilus, Cal Jader's Aquarius, that he liked Ramp's Daylight. I'm glad he knew he liked Jimmy McGriff's Green Dolphin Street. I'm glad that he knew he liked brother Jack McDuff's Obligato. Super glad that he knew he liked the Weather Report's Young and Fine. Glad that he liked A Chant for Boo, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. Glad that he liked the Young Rascal Sueño. I'm glad that he liked the Meter's Hand Clapping Song. I'm glad that he liked Albina Gorilla's Psychedelic Shack. I'm glad that he knew he liked Kool and the Gang's Electric Frog, Nairobi Sisters' Promised Land. I'm glad that he liked Les McCann's North Carolina. I'm glad that he liked Henry Franklin's Soft Spirit, Willis Jackson's Don't Knock My Love. I'm really glad he liked Eric Dolphy's 17 West. Yo, I'm just glad that he liked music, and that he bought records, and that he had a turntable, and that he linked up to make magic and history with Q-Tip, Jarobi, and Fife. Maybe he didn't know, but I'm so glad I have the chance to tell him how much he taught us. We got the jazz from him, snippets and touches, moments and cuts. Our guest is none other than he, one of the legendary founders of the seminal A Tribe Called Quest. He's the DJ. Ali Shaheed Muhammad in three words other than Ali Shaheed Muhammad, so many jams. He co-anchors the podcast Microphone Check alongside our homegirl, Franny Kelly. He has served as a co-producer for the Luke Cage soundtrack, which is fire. He is well known for his work with D'Angelo, Rafael Sadiq, Jay Dilla, and others. And alongside composer Adrian Young, he continues to marry visuals and sound to create beauty for projects like The Midnight Hour. For 30 years, he's been doing it and doing it well. I am so honored to say, thank you for your service. We got it from here. Ali Shaheed Muhammad, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Wow. Thank you, Morgan and Oliver. That's a nice way to enter into a place. I want to say to a lot of those records you mentioned that I have to give credit to Q-Tip because he introduced me to quite a few of them. But the love was definitely there. And so thankful that you guys have allowed it into your world because I know how special music is to people. And I'm just happy to be here today with you guys. So thank you.
Yeah. So we want to know why you chose this album. We have discussed that we were going to talk about All in All, so I just have to put that out, shots fired to Oliver. But we want to know why you chose this album, and do you remember what it was like the first time you heard the album?
It wasn't an easy choice, I have to say that. There are hundreds of records that are very meaningful to me and have helped shape not only my musical mind as a producer, but just me as a human being, you know. I did choose this one because at the time this album had come out, I think hip hop was changing, and even Public Enemy with this album had changed. You know, it was greatly different than Yo Bum Rush the Show, which That was also a really incredible album. And specifically, I had an uncle who used to work for Columbia Records, and he was actually working Public Enemy and brought home a signed autograph of Public Enemy number one from Chuck and Flavor. And I just was like, oh my, like I was, you don't understand, in my neighborhood of Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, like everyone was just like, how on earth did this ever happen? That, and I had an original test press of Lottie Dottie before the radio stations got that. So again, because of my uncle. And so just giving you, you know, little details, tidbits of, so anyway, I was into PE, but the second album, just sonically, it's hard to really put it into words. It was a journey. It was like, it was a very important album. And again, coming from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, New York, knowing that crack cocaine had changed the neighborhoods, knowing that young black teenagers, we didn't have much to look up to. We didn't have the respect of the government, of the communities. We were, and still are, looked upon as worthless to a degree. And you have this album that comes and changes your thinking from a musical level. It's just the beats are smashing. Everything is just tied together. You know, they honor the DJ. If there were a hip hop album that represented me outside of the works that I've worked on, then this would be it.
Here's a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me, the suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get up.
I'm just so curious, because if I have this, the dates right, you would have been around 18 years old when this album, or seven, I guess late late 17 years old, but you're still in your late teens when this album drops in 1988. You're living, as you said, in Bed-Stuy. You're in Brooklyn. What was the reaction to this LP immediate? Was it more of a slow burn? Like, what was it like being in New York at that age in that era when this album just kind of lands?
I think that really depends on where you were. I have, my parents were civil rights activists.
Mm.
And so my immediate community were nothing but conscious people, you know? And so in my small immediate community, this album was a big deal.
Morgan, how did this album land for you?
I just remember, and I don't know what show it was on, just seeing the video for Don't Believe the Hype. I think that was my earliest memory of this album. And if I recall correctly, it was like a mix of like live footage from the shows. I think like Flava had on the white jumpsuit, you know what I'm saying? Chuck D had on the white, somebody dancing real fast in the corner. It was an introduction. I was starting to be introduced to sort of like the pro-black rap. And so Public Enemy for me was just this, not necessarily a new sound because I was already listening to East Coast rap. It was a new energy. It was a new philosophy that I was being introduced to. So that was my introduction. Don't Believe the Hype was the gateway drug for me.
Don't believe the hype.
I got Flavor and all those things, you know.
Yeah, boy, part two bum rush the show. Yo, Griff.
Get the green, black, and red in. Gold down, countdown to Armageddon.
I want to spin back to something that Ali was saying a moment ago about just how different it was when this album landed. Because I think when we oftentimes talk about hip hop and the golden era in hindsight, I think there's a kind of collective feeling as if the political nature of hip hop had always been part of rap music from its very beginning. And if you actually look at what hip hop sounded like for most of the 80s, that's not the case at all. I mean, you have quasi examples like The Message by, you know, Grandmaster Flash and Melly Mel. But for the most part, there was nothing really remotely equivalent to what Public Enemy was doing once they came out with First Bum Rush the Show, but especially with It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold This Back. And that when we talk about hip hop's political nature, Public Enemy, as much as any other group, if not the most important group in that sphere, are the ones who introduced and created this association that we now have. And I went back and looked at the other seminal albums from 88. And 88 was, I mean, for hip hop was, my God. I mean, you got Critical Beatdown by the Ultramagnetic MCs. You got Slick Rick with The Great Adventures of Slick Rick. Big Daddy Kane debuts with Long Live the Kane. Obviously, you got NWA Straight Outta Compton. Eric B. and Rakim have their sophomore album, Follow the Leader. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And those are all really important albums. Any one of those could have been the focus of our discussion today. But then you compare all those other albums with It Takes a Nation of Millions, and it feels like P.E. was just on some other plane of existence, especially because they made an album that was a polemic. Like, it was an LP-length manifesto and statement. Mm. And you just didn't hear hip-hop albums doing that. I mean, hip-hop was doing other things, like amazing things, but not like this in-your-face, this is what we're about, here's our ideology. And I think that is something that I can only imagine. Again, I mentioned this in my intro. I wasn't listening to P.E. in 88, so I wasn't there in that moment to react to it. But looking back on it, I just have to imagine, yeah, this was something that nobody would have heard an equivalent to this at that point in time.
Public Enemy didn't sound like anything else, even on the East Coast. It was such a revelation. And if you weren't sure about what their philosophy was, you knew that from the sound bites. You knew that as soon as someone was like, brothers and sisters, you're like, here we go. You knew that from, you know, some of the spoken word that was on there, Khalid Abdul-Muhammad, you knew. Chuck D's voice was the voice of authority. It was the voice of revolution. You know, how low can you go? Bass, you know what I mean? You just knew. It galvanized you. It was a different vibe from all the rap I was listening to. And I was listening to a lot of music around that time, a lot of East Coast music, but it was so different than anything I had heard.
Well, actually, why don't we get into talking about Chuck and Flav? With Chuck D, I want to say it was either Greg Tate. Actually, I think it was Nelson George who wrote about the importance of this generation of baritone rappers and that the quality of that voice the kind of authoritativeness that the baritone gave people like Chuck and KRS and other folks like that was such an important way in which they presented themselves. And with Chuck in particular, one thing that I've noticed over time is that, you know, before, let's say, 1994, if you were to ask people to come up with a list of the greatest rappers on the planet, Chuck would have always been in the top five alongside Rakim, KRS, you know, Ice Cube, etc. It wouldn't even have been a debate about him being there. And somehow, as time has gone by, he's been taken off of that list, like not even dropped to like number seven. Like he's not even the top 40 for a lot of people today, which to me just seems insane. Because if you go back to It Takes a Nation, or if you go back to Fear of a Black Planet, you would never think he doesn't sound good anymore on this. Like there's no kind of way of retroactively demoting him. Like he was incredible. His presence in particular, I thought, was completely unrivaled. And even though I think later rappers might have developed more sophisticated and intricate flows, no other artists, or very few other artists to me, have ever commanded a record in the way that I think Chuck was able to, especially back then.
I agree with you 100%. The tonality of his voice was another, you know, part of the seasoning of the recipe. And I also think that Chuck might have been a little bit older than a lot of other rappers at the time period. Right. So mentally, I should say on an experience level, I think he was advanced. The tailoring of the sounds that was somewhat like just chaotic and confusing really blended well with the solid anchor that his voice had, that the content, the lyrical education, the, you know, like ripping off this PA, it was so well put together. Then to have Flavor just come out of, you know, this other side with his high frequency, you know, to kind of like give another, you know, another balance to throw you off. If this guy's being a little too preachy, like, let me hit you in the head with this other character right here that's gonna, you know, bring it down seemingly, but we're all still staying on topic, you know, hitting that goal. So it's unfortunate that Chuck is not mentioned. He will always be mentioned if someone asks me, but you know, they look at me now, I'm crazy old school. Like crazy. It's not even old school. It's like, yo, you crazy old school, man. Get out of here, grandpa. But the parameters today in terms of what makes an MC, you know, top five level is so different.
Right.
And so one cannot just get it on voice alone. And again, it's like, cool, then let's just default to style. Chuck was hitting different styles as a poet.
Yeah.
You know, like every song had a different style. Like he wasn't a battle rapper. And I think if he were a battle rapper, he was so advanced that I think it would have gone over everyone else at that time period. They wouldn't have even been able to give him his props, because it's like, yo, he's somewhere else.
The production of the Bomb Squad, in addition with Chuck's voice and then Flav as the answer, all work together, I think, to bring Chuck D's voice, to give it even more volume, to give it even more power. Because one overall feeling that I have when I listen to this album is crisis. The energy is very frenetic. It feels like people are running down the street. It does feel like Armageddon, right? And then you have out of the abyss, you've got Chuck D's voice telling you what's going on. And then, you know, he's like the serious side. And then you think that Flav is going to, you know, take it to another level, but he's sort of reinforcing what Chuck says, but he's more animated. We had a little bit of this discussion about, you know, these two different voices we were talking about, Only Built for Cuban Links. And we were talking with Havoc, and we were talking about the difference between, you know,
Ray and Ghost,
and how, you know, Ray's just, you know, calm and even keel telling the story, but then Ghost just comes in hyped, you know, he's got to punctuate. And that's what I thought Flavor did, but I also felt like his punctuation made Chuck's voice even more powerful, even more authoritative, even more, he instantly had credibility. And even though he wasn't a battle rapper, the production made it feel like a battle. He wasn't battling anybody else, But it made you feel like he was in a battle. You were right there with him. It was big. It was booming. It's like those scenes in movies where people are running through the street because everything's gone to shit and things are falling from the sky. And they're like, get out of here. Get. That's what this album feels like for me.
Yo, man, show them what you got. Show them what you got.
This style seems wild. Wait before you treat me like a stepchild. Let me tell you why they got me on file. Because I give you what you lack. Come right in next back. I'll status the status so I care where you at. Black in at home. I got a call from Tony Rome. The FBI.
I'm not a huge fan of boxing, but the times that I've watched boxing, one of my favorite interactions is when the boxer goes to his corner and his cut men come in and they're like, keep doing what you're doing. You know, you just got to keep jabbing, you know, keep doing. You got him on the ropes. You got him on the ropes. That's what Flavor Flav's ad-libs remind me of. They serve a dual purpose. One, to report back what's being said, because he's always reporting what's being said. Yo, Chuck, they're saying we too black out there. You got to tell him what. He's a reporter for what's going on, what's being said. In the media, on the radio, in the streets. And also, he's a hype man to Chuck to get him ready to spit that fire. And he does that all throughout Rebel Without a Pause. He's always telling him, Chuck, you need to, you know, go on, man, you know. And that's what I like. He like I said, he's a hell of a multitasker on these bars.
I caught you pissing your pants. You're scared of pissing us. The crowd is missing us. We're on a mission, y'all. Yo, Chuck. Yo, yeah, man. Yo, you got him running.
Ali, as a DJ and a producer, what is it that you hear the Bomb Squad doing, especially on this album, that really stands out to you?
I think that they have picked the best energy sources for this record. You know, when you're a band, you can easily, one person starts something, someone else feels out that energy, adds their own energy to it, and it mutates, it grows into something, you know. And if all the band members are really just in this kind of trance, this energy is, you know, transcended into something else, you know, that you probably could not, before walking in the room, say, this is what we're going to do today. You know, you may have an idea what your plan is, but when you come together, there's this energy that is established. So you're relying on having to dig through records to find all this energy to be the bedrock of the ideas that you want from this poet, you know. And they did an excellent job at just taking what seemingly, it sounds like chaos, but
yeah.
It is and it isn't. It's perfectly placed chaos. You have a song that starts off too black, too strong. It's like, what is about to happen here?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's how the song starts. Like, that hasn't happened before in hip hop. So it's like, oh shit. And then they come with it. And every song is bespoke, you know, every song. I mean, I've spoken with Hank about it a little bit. He never gave me the indication that they were just like, I don't know, we opened up the cupboards and it said some cinnamon and some whatever. We just threw the whole all spices in there. And we just, like, I never got that sense from it. I got the sense that they knew what they were picking. Myself being a DJ / producer, I know sometimes, you know, you're just listening for an element and you keep going. You know, it's like record after record. And you're just needle picking it up, moving it around. You're just trying to find that one element. And so, to be so dedicated to do that, because you're not going to find it in one place. And I don't think that PE cleared all of their samples. So if you break down the entire record, I'm pretty sure it's a publishing nightmare. But on top of that, it just, again, shows how all these little blips, these little clips, these pieces were perfectly placed. And so it's one of the reasons why the Bomb Squad has been like one of my favorite production teams, because it's, you can try to pretend and think like, oh, I'm just going to mash up and throw all these samples in there and come up with this gumbo. It's like, nope, you don't have it.
Right.
You know, and they were, whatever they had, their chemistry and the energy that they created from sampling, it's the best. It was what Q-Tip and I was striving towards. Like, they were so such an influence to, not that we wanted to, you know, sound like the Bomb Squad, but it was just the level of detail
right.
that they had. And right. so that's what Q-Tip and I were striving towards when we go into the studio. Prince Paul is another producer who doesn't get enough credit, but kind of, I think he's from that ilk a little bit. Yeah. You know, I don't know if that's that.
So some Long Island thing, right?
So I was about to say the water in Long Island. Yeah. I don't know if that's what it was to allow them to all kind of vibrate like that. But Prince Paul, he's definitely of that ilk. And we looked to those guys, and they were our center point.
Well, we're talking about samples. I guess it's fair to ask, what are some of our faves from the album? What, Ali, what are some of your favorite samples from this album?
It's funny, as much as I've listened to this album, I've never really dissected what it was that they did. If one really stands out, it's just the Spoonie G song. That's the only one that I know is like immediately in my head for Terminator X, To the Edge of Panic.
From the south to the west, to the east, to the north, come on, Spoonie G, and go off, and go off.
That sample, I think, is what I hate to use it and put it this way, but it kind of brought PE down to a. Then they weren't so esoteric. They were like, oh, they're right here on the ground. They're right here in the Bronx. Straight up, this is a Bronx tune right here with some new flavor added to it. So that was the one song, the one. Hands down. But everything else, I mean, I've never really broken it down.
Well, you know, I think part of it is because so many of the songs on here have a gazillion samples layered together. It's not in the same way, just to use maybe an obvious example, it's not like listening to a Tribe song and then plucking out like, well, what's that guitar on Benita Applebaum that starts it off, right? Because it's not like it's easily isolated in the Bomb Squad style, with the exception of, at least to me, what jumps out would be the Isaac Hayes piano stabs that are on Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos, which is taken from, and I'm not going to be able to pronounce this, but Hyperbolic, Syllabastic, blah, 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 right off of the Hot Buttered Soul album. It's one of the examples on this album where they're not going with that wall of noise style where you have, again, 20 things stacked on one another. It's much more minimalistic because they recognize that all you really need is to have those keys from Hayes. That'll do most of the work for you to set the tone, to give this song a sense of drama, a sense of intensity. And I think that it, for that reason, it stands out because it's not buried beneath anything else. It just gets to live on its own.
So I'm looking for the steel.
Hey, yo, Chuck, you serious? You in the justice, man?
Word them up. I'm looking for that steel.
Yo, man, we gonna break you out of there, man. We ain't gonna...
How about you, Morgan?
You know, I like Rebel Without a Pause because it's James Brown. It's the JB. So you hear, a lot of that drum, a lot of those drums that you hear in other places. But I think what I paid attention to is Showing What You Got. And I paid attention to it more this time because for whatever reason, when Jay-Z had Showing What You Got, I was like, what? I kept thinking, like, why does this sound familiar? And it didn't occur to me until listening back to this album. I was like, oh, my God. And I love that. And I played that over and over and over again. And that's a Lafayette Afro Rock Band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Darkest Light, yeah. We will be back with more of our conversation with Ali Shaheed Muhammad about Public Enemies, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, after a brief word from some of our sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked. We know there are, of course, many, many worthy causes out there, especially now. And we know that not everyone is in a financial position to become Max Fund mm-hmm. members. We understand that completely. If you are in a position to invest in this show, we would really appreciate you supporting our ability to make this show that we love doing, hopefully you love checking out every week.
We also want to shout out a couple of other Max Fund shows. We want to shout out Minority Corner, Fantai, Who Shot You. These hosts are also working hard as they're going through this to make sure that they've got something to share with you guys that's meaningful during this time. And we are really grateful for those of you that are rocking with us, that support our ability to keep doing this, not just for ourselves, but for everybody out there that enjoys what we do, and so that we can continue to do it. And we can only do it because of your membership.
We really appreciate all of the love audience folks and Max Fund members give us out there. This is all off of Twitter from TheMaxB. They say that gentle reminder that Heat Rocks Pod with myself and Morgan is, quote, one of the best music podcasts out. This is the intersection of fandom and scholarship where people love what they critique and critique what they love. So much care and research with each album they discuss, unquote. So thank you so much to the Max B for that very kind, very generous comment. And for everyone out there who has shown us love since we launched this show a couple years back, we really appreciate, as Morgan would say, the tweezies and the retweezies, but really just the sentiment and the support that folks have shown us over the years. It's such a pleasure and it's such a blessing to be able to see that.
Indeed.
If you want to become a member, all you got to do is to go to MaximumFun.org/join. That is MaximumFun.org/join.
Yo, and we're back on Heat Rocks talking It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back with Ali Shaheed Muhammad.
So, Ali, I got to ask you this. The first Tribe Called Quest single I ever bought, which was at Leopold's Records in Berkeley, California, rest in peace, was I Left My Wallet in El Segundo. And on the B-side, of course, was the song Pubic Enemy, which I still think is one of the greatest hip-hop puns in history. Did you all come up with the title first and then you wrote the song, or was it the other way around? And very importantly, did anyone in Public Enemy ever give you feedback about the song?
Nah, no one from PE ever gave us feedback, not to me. I don't know if anyone ever said anything to Q-Tip, but no. That song was done, I want to say we were 17 when we wrote that. So without giving away too much of that, it was just a moment in time is the best way to put it. And So Q-Tip decided to make a song about, you know, right. a situation that if you don't look after yourself. And the funny thing is that Barry Weiss, who was at the time the president of
Jive Records, right?
Of Jive Records, he refused to say Pubic Enemy. He would always say Public Enemy, and it's like,
there's no L in there, Barry.
Yeah, you know that's not the song name. You're like, you know it's not. Just come on and just say it. It's okay, Pubic Enemy. Say it slowly. But that was just a time, and you know, where who else had a song? Was it Kumo D? Go See the Doctor. You know, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it was a moment in time in hip hop.
Yeah. All right, turning our attention back to Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Let's get into, and I think this might be a tough choice given how many possible selections, but what is the fire track off of this album for you, Ali? When you first heard it, when you listen to it now, what is the one song that just boom jumps out at you?
That's tough, man. Rebel Without a Pause, you know, we talked about that.
Yeah.
And Terminator X, To the Edge of Panic. Mm. And more so maybe that, because it was a brilliant kind of a DJ spotlight featured song. Mm-hmm. But it was, which was popular at the time, you know, in hip hop, it would be those, you know, Tribe had one with Mr. Muhammad, you know, right, Eric B right. had one, Eric B for President, you know, so there was a time where people would, you know, kind of honor their DJs. But the beauty of this song was that, I mean, and it starts off like, again, I go back to this is like an epic movie about to take off, you know, starts off with that Flash kind of a soundtrack thing. hearing that, it's just like mind is blown. Like we barely into the record. We're barely 30 seconds in. It's just like, what is going on? But then Chuck comes in and it's like, I know this is a DJ song, but I'm keeping this on topic about what PE is about. Like we are really about our business and talking about the oppression of the government. Like we just laced it from a place where we got y'all. We hooked you. You thought it was going to be a DJ joint where you can just dance and wild out. But it's like, cool, do that. And I'm going to tell you about the government destroying black leaders, killing black leaders. Like he kept it on topic.
Playing them close, understand this type of music, kills the play of the clan. You know the pack attack the man with the palm of his hand. Police, wild beast, dogs on a leash. No peace to reach, that's why he's back in his black piece. Terminator X, yelling with his hands. Damn, almighty ruler written the jam, but...
It also, that song also features one of the great Flavor Flav ad-libs on there, which is, who gives a fuck about a goddamn Grammy?
Grammy.
And I don't want to detour too much here, but if we're going to talk about DJs and scratching on this album, I got to, you know, give recognition to Johnny Juice Rosado, who was a Puerto Rican DJ who did a lot of the cuts on both the first two Public Enemy, maybe even Fever Black Planet, but definitely on the first two albums. He was actually the one doing a lot of the scratching on it. Chuck actually did some of the scratching on some of the songs too. But Juice actually, he wasn't part of the group in a formal way. Oftentimes has not really gotten the credit for doing, to being called in to handle some of the more intricate scratching. I mean, X was apparently like a really great party DJ. He was a very good stage DJ in that sense. But in terms of the actual scratching work, it was Johnny Juice who was handling a lot of that work. So I just wanted to kind of put that out there. As someone who studies DJs, it's like, I want to give credit where it's due in that respect. Morgan, how about you? What's your fire track off of here?
Mine is, I got to say, Don't Believe the Hype. One of my favorite lines is, he says, some claim that I'm a smuggler. Some say I never heard of you, rap burglar. That's just one of my favorites. I'm like, ooh. Ooh. So I like that one. But I also love Rebel Without a Pause. What about you?
I mean, for me, Bring the Noise, just in terms of sheer energy. It's just... Even listening to today, it is such a atom bomb of a song, and the hypeness of it is so immense.
Bring the noise! Yo, they should know by now that they can't stop this bump. Bring the noise! Turn it up, and they keep telling me to turn it down, but yo, play the play, ain't going out like that.
We were kind of touching on this a little bit, which is about favorite moments on the album. So not songs, but really just moments that, especially for an album that I'm sure collectively here, we've heard countless times. And for me, it was then, and it still is now. It's on Bring the Noise, and it's the isolated, funky drummer break portion that comes out of the first chorus.
I'm saying inside the music that the critics are blasting me for. Oh my God. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo.
I don't know if that was the first time I heard Funky Drummer on a song, but it was definitely the first time that I heard Funky Drummer and thought, what is this? And just to isolate it and let that ride, even to this day, that is just, it has me so hype. Morgan, favorite moment for you?
You always put me in the hot seat. You know what I mean? But I love the beginning of Louder Than a Bomb, because the beginning of that song doesn't sound like the beginning of anything else on that album. There's that sweet Kool & the Gang sample of Who's Gonna Take the Weight. And then I'm just sort of like lulled into some smoothness, and right as I get lulled, Flavor's like,
they claim we're products from the bottom of hell, 'cause the black is back and it's bound to sell. Picture us cooling out on the 4th of July. And if you heard we were celebrating, that's a worldwide lie.
And I wasn't expecting that. So I like the twists and turns that song takes at the opening.
Just for Louder Than a Bomb, I wanted to say about that, to me, I think that is the definitive Public Enemy song, in my opinion. I think it's Chuck really being so, I don't give a fuck. He's older than me, so he's pretty sure, you know, witnessed the killings of Martin Luther King, you know, witnessed the killings or was around, maybe not eyewitness, but was around at right. the time of the killing of Malcolm X, the killing of John F. Kennedy, and so many other unsung civil rights activists, and seeing the silencing of people who are just trying to make people's lives better and being massacred only because of our skin color. And I think with louder than a bomb, I think he knew that he had the master weapon of his pen. He had the master weapon of not only television, because television at that point in time obviously gave a pivot to what was happening, you know, in the 60s, where people could can see this, these things happen in America, and where it was talked about like, oh my God, this is really happening, we got to do something about it, to having that moment to still, you know, shutting people off, but he still had that. In addition, he had the culture of hip hop, which was nonconformist at that time. And he had the power of the broadcast of his record company. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he can say some of the things that he said in that record. And it's not a matter of getting away with it. It's a matter of, you really got to deal with this. You can't tuck us under the way you've been tucking us away at this point. You know, really addressing the CIA, the FBI, like just straight calling them out, not hiding. You know, right. To me, that louder than a bomb is like the ultimate mission of Public Enemy.
Yeah. Two quick things about this too is, number one, and we keep hammering this point, it may not seem like a big deal for people to call out the FBI and CIA by today's standards, but again, who the hell was doing this in 1988, right? Let alone like a black man, number one, right? Number two, and this goes back to something we're talking about in the first half, is one of my favorite things about Louder Than a Bomb. I mean, everything, that Ollie, that you said is completely on point. But like Chuck and his flow on this song is incredible. Like stylistically, he is killing it on this yeah. song and saying something at the same time. But I always marvel at just the alacrity of his rhyme scheme that he puts together on this song.
Cold holding the load, a burden breaking the mold. I ain't lying, denying, because I'm checking my code. Am I bugging? Because I'm bugging my phone for information. No telling who's selling that power, building the nation. So joining the set, the point blank target. Every brother's a size, so at least not to forget, no. Taking a plane.
Well, anyways, we've been talking about favorite moments. Ali, do you have a favorite moment off of this album?
I can't say that I have a favorite moment. Mm. I really, like, I would have to listen through the whole album again and go, oh yeah, there we go, that's it. Right. There are so many moments of absolutely. This album.
Absolutely.
That they all just, this is one experience to me.
Yeah.
And like, even, you know, She Watched Channel Zero was like a weird song to me. Very weird. It doesn't stand out as a moment, but it stands out because Chuck never really addressed a woman or women in that regard, you know. And, yeah. you know, the merging of hip hop and rock, you know, was a thing that I think continued on after this. Yeah. And it's a different side of Public Enemy, but that song always was like the, I wonder if they decided, if there was an argument of, should we keep this on or should we take it off?
And they've taken a lot of heat for that song, especially from black feminists over the years, because it is one of the few songs where they're really addressing women and not in a particularly positive way. So, you know, it remains kind of one of the few divisive moments, I think, on this album for a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, yo, let me tell you a little something, baby. I'm going to take you stand, I'm going to throw it out the window, G. 2, 7, 5, 4, 8, she watched, she said, I'll add it up to zero, and nothing in her hand. She turns and turns, and she hopes the soul. Off a reel, she learns that it ain't true, no. But she won't survive, and rather die than lie.
You know, I've spent a number of shows, and Christian and Oliver can attest to, I have spent a lot of shows extolling the virtues of skits and voicemail messages and interludes. And this album did not disappoint for interludes, right? And one thing I like about the interludes is they don't feel like a stop moment of the album. They're so tethered to whatever came before it and whatever came after it that I'm not disappointed by that. Starting with Countdown to Armageddon, it is such a way, it's not an interlude, it's the introduction to the album, but it just gets you, you are ready.
Let me hear you make some noise! In concert for BBC Television tonight and a fresh start to the week, let me hear you make some noise for Public Enemy!
After that, I think my favorite is Mind Terrorist. And there's not much being said, but it is very cerebral and mental. It's like your conscience talking to you, you know, all through it.
Get that, yeah, boy. Bass for your face. Get that, yeah, boy. Bass for your face. Get that, bass for your face. Bass for your face.
You know, one thing that comes to mind in listening to that is, because we haven't talked about it, is their stage presence. And that particular interlude, like I saw PE a couple of times back then, and I'm like, was that like a moment where they kind of just like stepped off and like regrouped and changed the scene? And I don't recall, but it seems like that would be a moment to do that, which they were excellent at. You know, it wasn't just the studio sharpness, there was the stage. Like, seeing PE was, I didn't grow up going to see Kiss or Aerosmith or great rock bands. I saw Public Enemy, you know. I'm sorry, I didn't even see, you know, Parliament. Like, I was too young.
Yeah.
Or Earth, Wind, and Fire. But I saw Public Enemy. And to me, that was better than Ringling Brothers, you know, like. It was just like, what is going on right now? Like,
yeah,
I can't even put it to words when the S1s come out. It's just like, what? I felt like, oh, the world is over. Like, I've never seen anything like this. Is this a show? Is this real life? Is this like, are they just playing with everyone? Like,
Countdown to Armageddon.
Yeah. Felt like a real takeover. So, you know, that speaks to that.
Ali, if you had to describe It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back in three words, what three words would you choose?
Black, majestic. I'm trying to find another colorful word for fearless. And because I don't have it yet.
Yeah, I think fearless seems pretty good. Very.
I'm going to laugh, but I wanted something a lot more colorful than fearless. But I'll just leave it at that.
Black, majestic, and fearless. Yeah.
Let me tell you a little something, man. A lot of people on daytime radio are scared of us because they're too ignorant to understand the lyrics of the truth that we pumping into them clouds, that brain cells, that they're spotting under the wooden skulls they call caps. You know what I'm saying? But the S1s are straightening it out quick, fast, in a hurry. Don't worry, brave and vision ain't blurry. You know what I'm saying?
Last thing would be, we always want to leave our audience with something else to check out besides the album under discussion. And so, if people who are out there really got into It Takes a Nation of Millions, we want to give you something else to put onto your list. I was going to suggest that, and we've devoted an entire episode of Heat Rocks to this, but go back and listen to James Brown's compilation from 1986, In the Jungle Groove, because I guarantee you the Bomb Squad spent a lot of time listening to that comp, because a lot of the songs, and or I should say a lot of the samples that they use on this album, I think almost definitely came off of that compilation. And if I'm not too self-serving, then go listen to me and Morgan talk about that album to kind of get a sense of what made it such an important anthology and the ways in which it shaped sample culture, especially in the mid to late 1980s. And it's just a really funky album, because I mean, yeah, it's par excellence.
I want to bump the blow. One, two, three, four, get it.
Morgan, how about you?
Well, you know, I always have to. So I'd say skip ahead to 1990 and a jewel called To the East, Blackwards, from the legendary X-Clan, Professor X, the Overseer, Sugar Shaft, the Rhythm Provider, and Brother J.
Brother J.
You got the pro-black, black nationalists, and they are protected by the red, the black, and the green, sissy.
With the key.
Yeah, with the key. So funky. And you want a couple of tracks that you should check out on that one are two of my favorites, which are Raise the Flag and Grand Verbalizer, What Time Is It?
With you, the funk will never flow, but that's another blow. Make your move, thief apprentice, I never step. I'm a tribal move, your master hasn't figured yet. Bring your weapons to my sword and shield. What's the higher level if your shit ain't real? My mystic magic, what you gonna do? Think
before you step. Can I give you guys a little bit of history?
Oh, please.
So, I was born Muslim, but my mother and father got divorced when I was two. And so my mom, who had become Muslim when she met my father, went back to the church, and now she's just calls herself spiritual. So she's not tied in. But I say that to say I spent time in the mosque and I spent time in the church and a lot of time in church organizations, going to Bible camps every summer and Sunday school repeatedly. And at the age of 12 is when I met Brother Jay in a Sunday school class. And so that was my homie. And the crazy thing is, I would always see him in church. And at some point I stopped going. And freshman year of high school, they had this orientation before school, like a month before school. And come walking in is Brother Jay. And I'm like, yo. What are you doing here? So, you know, it's crazy. And then at some point, you know, we form tribe and he forms the X-Clan. And,
yeah.
You know, our paths have been pretty much aligned. So,
yeah,
just crazy how life takes you sometimes when you look back at it like that.
Morgan, what was your other choice?
Oh, my second choice would be America's Most Wanted. If you want to hear this type of production, Bomb Squad production, Chuck D, Flavor Flav, yeah, make an appearance, and of course, the banger that is Endangered Species. So that's those are the two I'd recommend.
When I got a sword, all bodies are hard off. It's a shame, and niggas die young. Blood to the light side, it don't matter none. It'll be a drive-by homicide, but to me, it's just another tale from the dark side. Standing in the middle of war, every minute we flex. When we die, fear won't make jet. Ebony can't see.
Ali, how about you? What would you recommend to our audience about what they should check out after It Takes a Nation of Millions?
Probably nothing from the world of hip hop. I mean, I understand the question is just keeping it in, you know, like you discover PE and this is the first one. So what's next? And, you know, clearly the next album. But this album is that rich to me that I actually wouldn't listen to anything. I'd need it.
It just shuts it down. That's a wrap of the day. Yeah.
I just need a time out to really digest it all because it is filling. Chuck is saying a lot. He's doing a lot. Flavor's doing a lot. It's why I chose this album. It's a powerful record, and it's not just like, oh, let me just have this going on in the background. You know, you could do that, but right. I'd say like if I were going to say to someone like, you should listen to, there's an album I want to introduce you to, I would then, you know, follow with, don't do anything else, just listen to this record. Like,
yeah,
you know, don't check your emails, don't check your text messages, don't go on IG, like, just listen to this record. So.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, who I'm honored to have on the show, Ali Shaheed Muhammad. Please tell us what you're working on now.
I'll just say long live Tribe, long live Lucy Pearl. Right now, presently, I have The Midnight Hour, so that's my band with Adrian Young. Adrian Young is also not only my bandmate, but he's my co-composer. When we put on, we take off our producer hats and our artist hats, then we put on our composer hats. And we're working on a couple of television shows that I want to be able to mention right now, but I don't think I contractually can mention them by name. But they're important, and people will be happy to see that we're associated with those and a movie. And the one thing that I'm really proud of our work, putting the producer hat back on, is Jazz is Dead, which is our event / record company. We released an album called Jazz is Dead 001, which features works of Roy Ayers, Gary Bartz, Doug Karn, Brian Jackson, Azimuth, Marcos Valle. I feel like I'm forgetting someone. This is horrible. And the Roy Ayers album will be coming out in a few weeks. Marcos Valle comes out in another couple of months after that. So right now we're just really trying to heavily promote the work that we did with those, oh my God, legends. Like this, you got to bring me back to talk about Jazz is Dead. But if you go to jazzisdead.co, you can see what we've been constructing there.
We just want to say thank you again to everyone who has gone out of their way to support our show by becoming Max Fund members. You all are really the reason that we continue creating the show, because without our audience, I mean, Morgan and I love talking music with one another, but we don't need to do it in this fashion. We're doing it because we know that you enjoy it. And through your feedback, we get a sense of what it is that you get out of this. And it's the same thing for us. So thank you again so much for your support and just being fans of the show over the years.
Thank you so much. And if you haven't had a chance to become a member yet, you can do so at MaximumFun.org/join. And thank you so much again.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.